Thank you for tuning in to The Global Novel. I'm Claire Hennessy. La Panse de Clèves is a French novel which was published anonymously in 1678. Many regarded the novel as the precursor to the modern psychological novel and a classic of world literature. Its author is generally attributed to Madame de Lafayette. The story recreates the era of the royal court of Henry II of France with remarkable precision. Nearly every character, though not the heroine, is a historical figure. Events and intrigues unfold with great faithfulness to the documentary record, and the novel is generally regarded as one of the first examples of historical fiction. The novel had an enormous commercial success upon its publication, and it was said that readers outside of Paris had to wait months to receive copies. It instantly sparked several public debates, including the controversy about its authorship and another even more moral controversy about the wisdom of the princess' decision to confess her adulterous feelings to her husband. One of the earliest psychological novels, The Princess of Clèves, marked a major transition in the history of the novel, which, to that point, had largely been used to tell romances, implausible stories of heroes overcoming odds to find a happy marriage, with a myriad of subplots and running up to 12 volumes. The Princess of Clèves, on the contrary, is unique for its highly realistic plot, introspective language that explores the character's inner thoughts and emotions. With me today is Dr. Benjamin Fancy, author of recently published essay titled Fantôme du Devoir, La Princesse de Clèves' Haunting Duty. Hello, Ben. Welcome to The Global Novel.
Hi, Claire. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I completed my PhD in French Studies at Brown University in May 2020. Shortly after that, I joined Princeton University. I was the Writing Center coordinator for a couple of years. I'm currently the associate director for the Writing Center there.
Sounds great. Well, let's go through the plot together, which, as you know, tells and explores the common condition of our own inner desire. Mademoiselle de Chartres is a sheltered heiress, 16 years old, whose mother has brought her to the court of Henry II to seek a husband with good financial and social prospects. When old jealousies against Kingsmen spark intrigues against the young ingenue, the best marriage prospects withdraw. The young woman follows her mother's recommendation and accepts the overtures of a middling suitor, the Prince of Clèves. After their wedding, she meets this dashing Duke de Nemours. The two fall in love, yet do nothing to pursue their affections, limiting their contact to an occasional visit in the now Princess of Clèves salon. The Duke then becomes enmeshed in a scandal at court that leads the princess to believe that he has been unfaithful to her in his affections. A letter from a spurned mistress to her paramour is discovered in the dressing room at one of the estates, but the letter was actually written to the princess' uncle, the Vidame de Chartres, who has also become entangled in a relationship with the queen. The princess' uncle then begs the Duke de Nemours to claim ownership of the letter, which ends up in the princess' possession. The Duke has to produce documents from the Vidame to convince the princess that his heart has been true. Eventually, the Prince of Clèves discerns that his wife is actually in love with another man. She confesses to him as much, and he relentlessly quizzes her and then tricks her until she reveals the man's identity. After he sends a servant to spy on the Duke de Nemours, the Prince de Clèves believes that his wife has been both physically and emotionally unfaithful to him. He then becomes very ill and dies of a broken heart. On his deathbed, he blames the Duke de Nemours for his suffering and begs the princess not to marry him. Now, free to pursue her own passions, the princess is torn between her duty and her love. The Duke pursues her more openly, but she rejects him, choosing instead to enter a convent for part of each year.
I really adore this novel. I think its significance is easily lost on readers today. I'd say The Princess de Clèves is generally not so well known outside of French circles, which is really quite a shame. As an undergraduate, I remember discussing it with a friend, an English major, who was reading it in translation for one of her classes and who loved it. But other than that one occasion in the US, I know The Princess de Clèves is really rarely taught in any other context other than a French literature class. And I think part of why it's less well known is, at least in part, because the beginning of the novel is not what I would call accessible to modern readers, particularly those less well versed in French history or less accustomed to reading early modern fiction. Mm-hmm. But if you push past the plethora of characters that are introduced in the beginning and the side stories that may not seem to make as much sense or whose connection to the main story may seem less clear, and instead focus your attention on the main character, the Princesse de Clèves, and what's happening with her, you find that there are many moments in which the novel reads more like what we would expect from fiction today. And that's what makes this novel so interesting. The most intriguing parts of the novel are the things that we might actually take for granted about it. It's investigations into the characters' motives and innermost thoughts, interspersed with intriguing interactions filled with emotional complexity. And there are, of course, the overarching themes of what it means to love, what it means to be devoted to someone, how one manages conflicting feelings and desires. All of these are themes that today's readers from a variety of backgrounds and experiences would surely appreciate.
Right. Well, the authorship has always been in the past something of a heated debate. So what do we know about the author and the authorship of the novel?
Some hold that the Princesse de Clèves may have been authored by a collective rather than by a single person, with Madame de Lafayette at the head of that collective. Mm-hmm. To some degree, that may be true. Madame de Lafayette's friends and fellow authors, François de La Rochefoucauld and Jean de Segré, were likely contributors in some fashion or another. This was actually quite a common practice at the time, since authors often knew each other, would sometimes write together, circulating drafts and receiving feedback from one another. In 17th century France, authorship didn't quite work in the same ways that we might think of it today. We often have this idea that one single author holds themselves up somewhere to produce a single work all on their own. Of course, that's not actually how it works in many cases. All you need to do is look at the acknowledgement section of a published work to see that authors receive feedback from a number of sources, friends, mentors, family members, and of course, editors. And that feedback helps shape the work as we end up reading it. Of course, authors today can and do benefit from circulating drafts and incorporating suggestions from others. Yet the full extent of the contributions of La Rochefoucauld and Segré to the Princesse de Clèves aren't known to us, and it's generally accepted that Madame de Lafayette is the novel's author, even though she herself never actually claimed ownership over the work.
Right. Well, the publisher's note to the reader in front of the book is quite fascinating to me. On the one hand, one can tell that the author wished to remain free of political censorship, while on the other hand, she seems to have the confidence that it might be a hit. So could you share more on the reception and the accessibility of the novel to a broader audience?
Absolutely. So yeah, the novel was indeed a great success and was widely publicized at the time. But it also received intense criticism, and it does seem that Madame de Lafayette believed that revealing herself as the author would only enhance any criticism it received. Mm-hmm. Even by the end of the first year in which the novel was published, 1678, the author Jean-Baptiste de Valancourt had already published a critique of the novel that would become one of its most famous. Valancourt's critique centered largely on the plot as being implausible, the main focus of this argument being, without getting too much into the details, that as her circumstances change over the course of the novel, the princess would never have made the confession that she made to her husband, or have remained as steadfast in her resistance to a romantic entanglement with her love interest, the Duke of Nemours. Verisimilitude was an important value of the time in works of literature. Nevertheless, even Valancourt remained impressed by the story, and Madame de Lafayette's contemporaries were captivated by the work. So whether positive or negative, the novel still received a lot of attention. It was, in many ways, the same characteristics that made the novel implausible to some readers that so captivated others.
Right. Well, the Princess of Clèves is also known as one of the precursors to modern novels. Strictly speaking, it is actually a novelette, stories of short or middle length. It is called nouvelle in the French literary tradition, meaning historical novel, right? So what do you think is the message that the author might have intended to deliver by placing our protagonist, who is perhaps the only fictional character, in the genuine historical setting of the royal court of Henry II of France?
There are a few possibilities for why this may have been the case. It's true that this would have been one way to avoid censorship, as you'd alluded to above. This sort of choice can also have served to allow the author to comment on her contemporary situation by creating an analogous one in the past. By situating the novel in the past rather than the present, any references to figures from Madame de Lafayette's own life wouldn't be able to be made as explicitly. This type of fiction, which was common to the time, was known as a roman à clé, or literally novel with a key, where individual characters in a story could be matched to others in the author's life using a sort of key or list of names that would correspond to one another. But this may not be the case. Regardless, what is clear is that this court setting is a space that is thoroughly contained. It's a setting with strict rules and conventions that the Princesse de Clèves has to abide by. And there are other conventions that she creates for herself or interprets for herself. I had mentioned earlier that verisimilitude was one of the values of fiction at the time. So were what were referred to as the three unities, unity of action, time, and place. These conventions were generally respected in works of theater and to some extent are respected in the Prince de Clèves as well. The contained setting of the novel, primarily in the court of Henry II, though there are occasional travels elsewhere, also takes place over a relatively short span of time, and in spite of the side stories and historical detail, the plot is nevertheless focused primarily on one main action, the connection between the Princesse de Clèves and the Duke of Nemours, and the events that take place to develop that connection.
Could you please talk a little about in what ways can the Princess of Clèves be considered as the novel?
So if you think about the origin of the word novel as meaning new, there's a lot that's new about this novel. Mm-hmm. Around the time of La Princesse de Clèves, novels as we think of them generally took the form of much longer works or collections of works that by modern standards are completely inaccessible. There's mm-hmm. a reason why there are far more classes on French theater from the 17th century than on French fiction from the 17th century. If the cast of characters introduced at the beginning of La Princesse de Clèves feels overwhelming, it's nothing compared with some of the novel's contemporaries. And the love story that I mentioned earlier between the Princesse de Clèves and the Duke of Nemours takes an entirely unique approach to love. This is precisely the detail that many critics find implausible. The Princesse de Clèves' continued and steadfast resistance to the Duke of Nemours and the unique strategies that she takes to uphold that resistance in spite of the intense love that exists between them. Yet the narrator provides us with an incredible amount of detail about the princess's thoughts and feelings, her reasoning for her actions, and her interior world in general. This level of psychological detail was unprecedented in French fiction at the time.
Right. Well, could you share more on the psychological aspect of the narration, as you just mentioned, and in particular, the development of the Princess of Clèves' interior world?
Sure. So I was actually first introduced to the novel during a survey class on French fiction as an undergraduate student, and I remember being absolutely fascinated by the ways in which certain words such as vertu in French, or duty, devoir, appeared and how they were used in the novel. So much text is devoted to the Princesse de Clèves' own grappling with these concepts, their meanings, and her relationship to them. This in and of itself isn't new. Big questions, of course, have always been debated in literature. But what is new is that the Princesse de Clèves often debates these concepts on her own, with herself. Most often in other fiction of the period, characters might discuss these issues with one another, but the princess is so often by herself. The narrator recounts how she reflects on these issues, expressing her thinking in great detail. Even the fact that the princess continually seeks ways in which to be alone is unusual. Mm-hmm. The court is not a place where characters generally seek solitude, but the princess continually does so. And it is when she is alone that she comes to some of her most important resolutions about how she will conduct herself in relation to her husband, the Prince de Clèves, and her love interest, the Duke of Nemours.
Right. Well, what are other major modes of reading and interpreting the novel?
There are many. This is a work that has received a great deal of critical attention in French scholarly circles. I'm far from the first to have focused on one single word and the ways in which it plays itself mm-hmm. out in Lafayette's novel. Domna Stanton, for instance, has written at length about the ideal of repos, or rest, in the Princesse de Clèves. Repos is another term that gets repeated and used a lot throughout the novel. Mm-hmm. Others, such as Catherine Jensen, have studied very closely the relationship between the princess's mother, Madame de Chartres, and the mm-hmm. ways in which she breaks with certain conventions of the time around how mothers raise their daughters. And of course, outside of scholarly circles, there was a whole movement that rose up around La Princesse de Clèves beginning around 2006 in response to remarks from the former French president Nicolas Sarkozy. Mm-hmm. In France, to give some backstory, those who wish to become public functionaries have to pass a state exam, and mm-hmm. that exam includes a cultural knowledge section. Sarkozy, mm-hmm. who himself admitted finding La Princesse de Clèves to be challenging in school, had criticized the choice to include that novel on the exam, famously saying, "I don't know if it happens to you often that you ask a counter clerk what she thought of The Princess of Clèves." There was a movement that rose up in defense of the Princesse de Clèves and the importance of the cultural heritage it represented for all French citizens. So mm-hmm. an attack by a major French politician on Lafayette's novel came to represent for many an attack on the value of culture and literature to French society as a whole. In 2009, for instance, during semester-long university strikes, students staged public readings of Lafayette's work. People passed out pins that said, "I read the Princesse de Clèves, je lis la Princesse de Clèves." Mm-hmm. Well-known French authors such as Marie Dariussec wrote defenses of the novel. It's truly a monumental piece of French cultural heritage that still has a mm-hmm. lot to teach us about ourselves, our interior worlds, and our relationships to others.
Wow, that is very interesting to hear. Let's talk about your essay, Fantôme de Devoir, which means Ghost of Duty, The Princess of Clèves, Haunting Duty. Could you talk about your perspective and reading of the novel that you introduced in this quite enlightening essay?
Sure, thanks. I'll be glad to. Mm-hmm. So my original entry point into this topic had to do with my interest as an undergraduate student, as it mentioned, on the value of repeating words and concepts in this novel. Devoir is one of those words that comes up very frequently in the novel, as I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. The repetition of this term is something that might easily get lost in translation, actually, because devoir in French means duty as a noun and must or should as a verb, also to owe. It has lots of potential meanings depending on the context. Mm-hmm. So as I read and reread the novel in graduate school, I also found myself becoming ever more intrigued by the ways in which deathbed scenes play out in the novel. At one point, I stumbled upon a book by historian Philippe Ariès on the history of death mm-hmm. and began imagining how his study might provide different perspectives on La Princesse de Clèves' deathbed scenes. Mm-hmm. So pause here briefly to alert your listeners who haven't yet read the novel that there might be a few spoilers ahead without going into too much detail. So in my article, mm-hmm. I study how the Princesse de Clèves is in some ways haunted by the psychological mm-hmm. ghost of an important and influential figure in her life, her mother, Madame de Chartres, who mm-hmm. passes away partway through the novel. I argue that it is because the princess's mother actually bends or breaks several of the conventions that made death more palatable to the living in 17th mm-hmm. century France, that mm-hmm. she establishes a sort of psychological hold over the princess that continues on even after she dies. Mm-hmm. So over the course of the novel, I view the Princesse de Clèves as continually attempting to reconcile herself to that loss precisely because it was so tumultuous. Perhaps even more so, or at least differently than is the case today, in the 17th century in France, there were a number of rituals surrounding death that were designed to help the living accept the loss of their loved one, as much as they aided those who were dying in achieving peace before passing on. Mm-hmm. This included giving the living access to the deathbed of the dying person and keeping emotions largely under wraps in that person's final days. So, knowing that from Ariès's study, when I revisited the deathbed scene of Madame de Chartres, I noticed that the Princesse de Clèves was actually banished from her mother's deathbed, and she experienced, perhaps because of being kept from her mother's side and mm-hmm. the nature of her mother's last words to her, I saw a great deal of emotional turmoil leading up to and following Madame de Chartres' death. Madame de Chartres painted the court and its intrigues as a very dangerous place for her daughter, even after she was married, and perhaps especially after she was married. And her mother does not exactly provide reassurance that things will get better. Quite the opposite, in fact. The mother's name reappears frequently throughout the novel after she dies, particularly in moments when the Princesse de Clèves is alone and reflecting on her situation. I began viewing these moments as attempts by the princess to reconcile herself to her mother's death, since she wasn't able to before her mother passed away. Mm-hmm. I then study other important scenes from the novel, from this perspective, interpreting them through this lens to reveal how the princess continually writes and rewrites the story of her mother's death throughout the rest of the novel. It was delightful, honestly, to revisit the novel from this perspective, even though it might seem kind of dark to be focusing so much on death. I think what keeps fascinating me about it is that it continues to surprise readers and is full of possibilities for new approaches to studying and interpreting it. There's something pretty remarkable about the princess, the choices that she makes, and the development of her interior world.
Thank you so much, Ben, for sharing your knowledge on The Princess of Cleves with us today. It was great fun talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Claire. It was a pleasure talking with you as well.
If you like this episode, you can show your support through theglobalnovel.com/donate so we can keep making academic education in literature more accessible to more and more listeners of the world. Thank you so much for listening.